This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
Here, I am joined here with Kevin Kautzman. He's a playwright. He has a new play out, Moderation, and he's also co-host of Art of Dark podcast, and also has written for web series. Kevin, it's great having you on the show.
Yeah, hey, thanks for having me, Robert. I appreciate it. You nailed the pronunciation of my surname there, so I appreciate that. First try.
Yeah, it seems pretty simple. You get a lot of mispronunciation.
Well, I mean, over the years, you get some weird ones. Kautzman, Kautzman. They just can't hit it. So, no, that's fine. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I mean, I've taken some German lessons, so...
There you go.
That's probably what it is, but I could see why for some people.
Yeah. I mean, we picked up the T at Ellis Island. We really probably shouldn't have the T, but Anglos can't quite hit the German Z, so we picked up the T. Yeah.
So with Moderation, that play, that's premiering online. That's an online performance. Like with the COVID, there's not as many in-person performances. Can you talk about Moderation? And is this your premiere play, or you're a playwright? Have you written a number of other ones?
Yeah, I've written quite a few plays over the years. Moderation is my latest, and what's coming out tomorrow, which is going to be Sunday, March 21st at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, is the latest iteration of the play. There's a theater company in Manhattan called Up Theater. They're based in Washington Heights, so way uptown. I happen to... have lived there for like 5 years. I lived in the Heights, but I never met these folks while I was living there. It was only after I sent this play around and they picked it up. It is a Zoom kind of it's a reading really of the play. So you know, the play has two actors. It's going to be presented by Zoom. We've already pre-recorded it. It was edited, and then after that, there's going to be a talkback. The play is a dark comedy about social media content moderators losing their minds at work. and so the play, if you want to learn more about it, everything is at moderationplay.com. What you're going to find there is a podcast version of the play, which itself was in turn based off a previous Zoom reading of the play that a theater company in Washington, D.C. did. So there's a theater company called Spooky Action. They did a Zoom reading of the play. This is all a very good sign for the extended life of the play, because when we come back, you know, online in the real world, such as it is, it probably means the play is going to have a nice, good, long life. But for now, we're stuck on Zoom. So long story short, I met Jeff Giese online. I met him on the Bird website, and he reached out, really liked the play. We adapted the D.C. theater company's performance of it into a podcast. So if you want to listen to that, go to moderationplay.com. But I'm also going to keep that updated because, again, there's this thing happening tomorrow that this new theater company is going to do, and there's another theater company in Manhattan that wants to do yet a third Zoom-style reading of this summer. So it's a very interesting thing, and it's really cool to see a play like come to life like that.
Do you want to mention your other plays previous to that? Like, what was your... How long have you been a playwright, and how?
Sure.
Just the background of how you got into writing.
Yeah, sure. So I wrote my first play in, I'm trying to remember. I mean, it's been almost 15 years now when you know, when I went into the theater, and I had a play that I wrote in grad school, which was my MFA play. It's called Dream of Perfect Sleep. I wrote that in 2011, if I'm not mistaken. This is all, it's all kind of a blur. and that had a nice solid premiere in London at a theater called the Finborough, which is a very, very cool pub theater in West London that kind of punches above its weight. If you know the play The Pillow Man, if I'm not mistaken, it premiered there. Yeah, you know, and I had reviews in The Guardian and everything. There's a producer who, oh, not a producer, excuse me, a publisher, who I sent my play. It's a play about, it's actually kind of funny. It's a play about online sex work. It's called If You Start a Fire, Be Prepared to Burn.
And was that, the web series, The Money Shot Show, is that connected?
Yep, right. So If You Start a Fire, Be Prepared to Burn, I had a production in Michigan and then a production in New York City. And wasn't really widely reviewed, but out of that, one of these publishers, they publish these like annual monologue books for actors, right? Actors are always hungry for new monologues. They typically have to bring, you know, for auditions, they have to bring like a classical monologue and then a modern contemporary monologue. And every year, the actual full script of Fire to date hasn't been published, but one of the monologues from it has. So every year I would hear from actors, you know, hey, can you send me the full script or is it published? And I would have to say, well, I'll send it to you. Here's the PDF, but it's not in print yet. Well, you know, now flash forward 10 years, we now live in, you know, the OnlyFans hellscape, you know, where this stuff has sort of conquered the world. My play was maybe, I know this is going to sound boastful, but it was maybe a little too ahead of the culture, right? So I send it to this publisher and I say, hey, look, you know, check this out and check out moneyshotshow.com, which is this comedy web series that's based on a pilot that we wrote, which is in turn based on the concept of the play. Whew, you know, a lot going on there. So I sent it to him and he got back, and it's this great publisher, Broadway Play Publishing. They're one of the big publishers, and they're going to publish a new edition of Dream of Perfect Sleep, which is cool. That was published in the UK, but no American publisher has picked it up yet. And then they're going to publish the first edition of If You Start a Fire, Be Prepared to Burn. So I'm kind of pitching those. Yeah, and if people want to check out moneyshotshow.com, it's just five webisodes in this comedy web series about kind of the funnier side of online sex work. And it's really more about the performance and the parasocial relationships and this sort of strange world that we now inhabit, where we're living online.
So your podcast, which you co-host, that's fairly new, The Art of Darkness. It's a podcast covering artists, different historical figures. So far, you've done several, including Oscar Wilde, William S. Burroughs, and a few others that I'm less familiar with. But is this just kind of artists in general, or there's a very specific theme or niche in your interest?
Yeah, so that's a podcast that I'm doing with my very good buddy Brad Kelly, and he and I met in graduate school. He's a novelist himself, and the concept of the show is that at this point, twice monthly, we introduce one another to the life and the work of an artist with an emphasis on their dark side. On the real dirt, right? So for Burroughs, that stuff is pretty obvious. We started with him; it seemed fitting. You know, not a very good man at all. and that's the focus. So we've done to date. We've done Burroughs. We did Wilde. We did Gurdjieff. And then we're recording one tomorrow, and Brad is handling that. And then after that, we're going to go on to Kubrick. We did another one. Oh, the name escapes me. Let me, I'm going to have to look it up right now. But yeah, people can find that.
You did one on Kafka's sister?
She's not really Kafka's sister, but that's what they call her. Anna Kavan.
Right.
Yeah. Indeed, yeah.
I listened to some of that, but I'm less familiar with her.
Yeah, right, and clearly I am too, although Brad did a fine job. I'm just having to be extemporaneous here. But that was very interesting. I didn't know about her. I want to read some of her work now that he's sort of introduced me to it. But the whole point of that podcast is to sort of, I don't know, kind of remind ourselves that this purity spiral that we're in this culture is completely unsustainable, and that imperfection and flaws and addictions and the dark side of our humanity are as essential to art as any political signaling or whatnot. It isn't to make an excuse for bad behavior, but it's to emphasize and point out that the messiness of human life is going to come at you, and artists have to work with that material.
Yeah, I definitely want to get into the whole discussion about cancel culture, but to start things off, I want to kind of look over Oscar Wilde and his life story and just kind of the image of his persona. Obviously, he was a playwright, and kind of his background, Oscar Wilde's place in and relationship with Victorian society. What did you find most notable about Oscar Wilde, either the commonly known persona, or stuff that you discovered that are less well known?
Yeah, the first thing that pops into my mind is that he could really handle himself. And he was not frail. He wasn't effete, per se. He was quite stout, and he would knock heads, and he did so at Oxford, famously. There's a story where he held his own against four fellows at the college. And his the father of the young man, Bosey, who he had the infamous affair with.
Is this the affair that led to his imprisonment?
Correct. Yes. Right. The father of Bosey, his name is on the rules for modern boxing. So actually, the name escapes me right now. But he knocked on Wilde's door at one point, and Wilde stood his ground and kind of fended him off. So this was not. He wasn't some sort of weakling. Which I think maybe we have this sort of.
So you think the stereotype is just because he's a gay icon?
Yeah, right. I mean, and maybe I'm overreaching there, but yeah, I think there's this kind of weird dandy stereotype. This idea that we're and it wasn't that at all. And he sort of wonderfully he came to America, and was in America for I think over a year on a speaking tour. More or less in promotion of a play that was or a musical that was kind of based on his life and his style, and he went all the way west. He went all the way to I think he made it to California.
He had a grand tour, a speaking tour, or just to travel, but he did have go on a grand tour of America.
Yeah, he went on a grand, and he brought that back to England, and so it's kind of like maybe the Beatles a little bit. There's sort of okay, well, you've made it in America. And now, if nothing else, he could have coasted on those stories about the American frontier for a decade.
So this was, I think this was the late 19th century, so it would have been, find it was still sort of the kind of tail end of the Wild West, and he did practice shooting with cowboys. He could basically outdrink most of them, and he did find the kind of... the kind of culture of the Wild West as refreshing as an alternative to bourgeois, industrial Britain. San Francisco was his favorite city. I mean, that was probably prior to it became a hub for gay culture, but it was San Francisco back then was still kind of, it kind of got its start during the Gold Rush. It was where this was after the Gold Rush, but where all the miners would go. A lot of gambling and saloons, so that was probably, I guess, the image of San Francisco at that time, and then he also had an affinity for the South and also, the Confederate cause.
Yeah, yeah, these things are not at all what we would project backward, and so reading about that, was really, really fascinating, and remembering, too, that that the Irish were... reviled.
Wasn't he born in Ireland, but I think he was English. He grew up Protestant.
He was a Protestant, but there were cartoonish depictions of him. I think it was in Harper's Magazine, if I'm not mistaken. I have a copy of the latest Harper's here, where he was depicted kind of like looking like a monkey.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And they were satirizing him.
In the U.S. or in Britain?
It was in the United States. Yeah. So there's one right now. You can find it. Cover image of Harper's Weekly captioned "The Aesthetic Monkey." So they're saying it may be an Oscar Wilde satire. So, you know, this may be somewhat, apocryphal, but it's, you know, his reception was mixed in the United States. So he caused a scandal, but he used it to his advantage until it finally everything brought, you know, crashed in on him. But that was many years later.
Yeah, he had the philosophy of aestheticism, truth and beauty, art for the sake of art, and kind of relevant to, like, those who try to find beauty in ugliness. And, I think in your podcast you mentioned the example of, like, kind of beauty in horror, ruin porn, which, can be fascinating, but there's also a kind of like with, like, woke culture, there is this obsession with seeing that there are no, like, beauty standards, or taking something that would have been considered ugly in the past and saying it's beautiful is a cliche in wokeness. So it seems that, like, Wilde, did he believe that that was, like, he saw that as, like, morally corrupt? I'm not sure if there's, like, a exact quote, but he believed that beauty transcended economic and moral concerns. The philosophy of asceticism and going back to, like, the neoclassicism of the era and the Hellenistic or Greco-Roman ideal of the ascetic. The belief that beauty transcends all other political concerns or should be the focus. I'm not sure if it's more, like, asceticism is more about creating, being an artist, and, like, the purpose of art should be purely about beauty and aesthetics, rather than social commentary. Does it go further to a political ideology? But how much have you, how many sources do you have about, like, asceticism?
I mean, you know, for this episode, I really focused on Wilde and his life. What really shocked me, and what I think everybody should expose themselves to, is the prison letter that he wrote, De Profundis, and it's all laid out there. There's an excellent performance of it, and let me see if I can look it up right now.
Is his prison letter, is it more about his personal life, or does he get into the political philosophies?
It's all there. It's very thorough. It's about his relationship to God and forgiveness. It's really wonderful. You can listen to it all on YouTube. There's a reading of it where this actor simply reads the entire letter and delivers Wilde's kind of coming to God through his time in prison. As far as his specific politics, I think he lived kind of, he flirted with socialism. I think he met with Shaw at one point. But I don't think that his life wasn't really political in the sense.
He wasn't really a political thinker. He was primarily an artist and a satirist. So it was kind of a side note. But it seems to be, like, I have, like, if you research, like, the politics of Oscar Wilde, there's, like, a number of different sources on that. So it's a kind of, he seemed to have been aligned with the left of his day. But then you kind of have to ask, like, where does he fit into today's political dichotomy?
Yeah.
Kind of flirted, like, sometimes associated with, like, libertarian socialist, but does seem he had a kind of, like, aristocratic radical philosophy.
Yeah, he was
influenced by Nietzsche. Like, he wasn't, like, like an egalitarian. And then he was also kind of critical.
Oh, not at all. Not at all.
Yeah, as a kind of, like, or almost kind of idea of, like, Aleister Crowley, sometimes called, like, aristocratic communism, kind of similar to that philosophy. And then also, like, the right, like, the politics of the art, the concept of the artist as a creator or sort of, like, Brahmin class, and very critical of the bourgeois society, but not so much from, like, your standard Marxist standpoint, but more just, like, he valued leisure, but in a sense, a kind of aristocratic sense, but he did want to liberate the masses from labor and utility in order to create art. So it's a kind of like he dreamt of a post-scarcity economy that some are talking about with like solutions, with technological solutions, like with automation and AI.
Yeah, he was an elite, and I don't think he ever really tried to present himself as a common man by any means. That would have bothered him. He had a quote about something: you can never be overdressed or undereducated, something like that. So, very interesting figure. I really enjoyed studying him, and his plays are amazing, and they really hold up. We also, it's another interesting thing to try to trace back our culture of Instagram and the self and this sort of quasi-narcissistic relationship we have with media and technology to a figure like this, which is so grandiose and so flamboyant and so about the individual over the collective in a radical way, where now we would take all this stuff for granted, right? We've gone through, you can trace this forward to Crowley and then to the hippies and everything, and this is the society that we inhabit now, for better or worse. It has tons of problems, of course, but at the time it was purely radical because of the Victorian sensibility and the obsession over status and the family and all the rest of it. It's really shown well in the importance of being earnest. You owe it to yourself to watch the great classic film production of that. If you do nothing else with Oscar Wilde, I'd say read or listen to the Neil Bartlett reading of De Profundis from the prison where he was, where Wilde was, imprisoned. And then also watch The Importance of Being Earnest, the classic film version. Yep.
Yeah, he does have a lot of like really witty, notable quotes. And some of them are actually very unwoke. But if you had to like select a handful of like the most notable of his quotes.
Yeah, I think I butchered that first one. You can never be overdressed or overeducated. I think that's great. I mean, these are great. He had some wonderful ones. Let me see if I can find some off the cuff here. Wild quotes. I mean, this is a guy who Twitter would have been made for him. He would have absolutely.
Do you think he would have been? Yeah. Do you think he would have thrived, or do you think he would have been a target of cancel culture if he was alive today?
Well, he was a victim of cancel culture in the time. The entire society back then was infested with a similar energy. We just have a new version of it, of course.
Or even someone like Milo. Like Milo is not. I wouldn't put Milo in the same. He's not of the same caliber, like he's not as on an intellectual level, but in the sense of being like a showman, kind of a showman, there are some parallels.
Sure. Yeah, I would possibly say that. You're definitely trying to get a rise, and we live in a society that's increasingly numb and atomized. So it feels like there's a fine line between artistic achievement and being someone who's simply famous for the sake of being famous. I'm not speaking about Milo in particular, but Wilde.
He was a great artist and intellectual, but he was also like about the spectacle, which is really taken off in media.
Yes, and he was about the spectacle first. So Wilde wrote a book of poetry, created this figure of himself at Oxford, which was sort of famous for having a certain style and a certain manner, quietly a genius, legitimately a genius, top of his class at Trinity, top of his class at Oxford, absolutely crushed, but he was intentionally seen to never be studying. So he surprised them all. And then to come to London with all this swagger, but very little to show for it. His first book of poems were panned, but he's famous for being famous. The Gilbert and Sullivan made this play or this musical mocking Oscar Wilde's style, and that's when they sent him to America to front run the play in, or the musical in order to educate the Americans in what was being satirized, because Wilde was this figurehead. But then he would go on. So he's definitely, like I said, he's somebody who could have just simply coasted on this. He could have just been in high society and made a living lecturing, perhaps, and never actually creating something. But then he did go on to write some of the finest plays of his era, and legitimately created these incredible works of art. And Dorian Gray is one novel that still holds up, that's still read and referenced. The four or five major plays are still referenced. So this is a guy who, you know, could back up his bark with a bite. I have a quote, because we missed that. This is a good one and very pertinent to what cancel culture and how I think a lot of it is competition for increasingly scarce resources and opportunities to actually achieve distinction in a society that's been flattened out and kind of numbed by this technology, and then also just a garbage quote unquote real economy. So it's like people are just battling for attention and all the rest. But he said this: a good friend will always stab you in the front. That's a good one, right?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So there's a lot to chew on there. I hope I'm not going on too much, but yeah. So such an interesting figure, and I think worth here's another good one. Be yourself, everyone else is already taken. So there's that radical self, 19th century.
Yeah, so the other podcast you recorded was on William S. Burroughs, and so this is a time frame, it's maybe about like 50 years later in history, but there are like some parallels, but Burroughs is associated more with the Beatniks, and he was also from an elite background. William S. Burroughs came from a wealthy family. It was Missouri, and he was a closet, going over kind of his biographical details. He was closeted about his homosexuality in his youth, and that's taking into account like what era he grew up in, like 20 would have been like the 20s and 30s, and he was also fairly late to writing. Burroughs got started probably in his 30s, maybe 40s, and to start things off, can you give sort of like a background, like where was Burroughs like in his youth? I guess some of the other connections, like his family connections did bail him out of trouble prior to the murder with his wife, and then he was for a while an exterminator.
Yeah.
Which was inspiration for Naked Lunch, and he was kind of a neat, and he did like really seem to value leisure, and that's true with a lot of creative types. But he came from a wealthy family. Then he became like drug addicted. I don't think he really got into hallucinogenics, which is surprising. You'd assume that from Naked Lunch. But it seemed mostly morphine and then later heroin.
Yeah, yeah. He was a very difficult figure. And this is an episode, if you listen to the podcast, it's at artofdarkpod.com. I covered the Wild episode. My colleague Brad covered the Burroughs episode, so I might not be quite as versed in the Burroughs material. But, he was a really interesting figure who had a huge effect on the Beat Generation, and his life was completely wild. But yes, as you mentioned, another elite, another bisexual, closeted homosexual figure, had a tremendous effect on the culture, still affects the culture, people still read him, and got hammered one night in Mexico, I think it was Mexico City, famously...
I think it was like a drinking game, so he had like a tequila shot on his wife's head, and he shot his wife accidentally through like a drinking game. But the thing is, like, I don't think he was ever like incarcerated or prosecuted for that, or he may have fled. He may have fled Mexico, but how much of a long-term impact did that have on him?
Yeah, I'm sure that it affected him for the rest of his life, and he did associate that event with almost quite literally kind of a demonic possession. I have it here. I mean, you know, so I'm looking at it. Burroughs described Volmer's death, his wife's death at his hands, as a pivotal event in his life. And he's saying it provoked his writing by exposing him to the risk of possession by a malevolent entity he called the Ugly Spirit. And then this is what he said. I am forced to the appalling conclusion that I would never have become a writer but for Joan's death, and to a realization of the extent to which this event has motivated and formulated my writing. I live with the constant threat of possession and a constant need to escape from possession, from control. So the death of Joan brought me in contact with the invader, the Ugly Spirit, and maneuvered me into a lifelong struggle in which I have had no choice except to write my way out. So writing as this almost shamanic, or, you know, like an exorcist.
He was into, like, black magic, like Crowley was. Yep. Yeah, so he was living in Mexico at the time, and he kind of thrived, like, in the chaos of Mexico City, but doesn't seem like he was, I don't know if he was, like, pursuing hallucinogenic substances like ayahuasca. I think he was mostly just, like, heroin. And then, but the thing is, he wasn't really religious in a traditional sense, but he had his own esoteric belief that there was this parallel universe that existed within the human mind, and a lot of different kind of rituals, like, relevant to black magic, but then some of it almost seemed more kind of like magical thinking OCD. But his own, like, paranoia, like his kind of psychological or spiritual outlook is explored within Naked Lunch.
Yeah, I do think I need to correct you, because he did actively go out and try to find ayahuasca in the, I don't know, at a certain point after he left Mexico. He went to find that, and apparently did, and he wrote a book about that experience called The Yage Letters. Yeah, it was letters between Burroughs and Ginsberg, rather. So.
Oh, right.
But his primary drug, the primary drug that we associate with him would definitely be, I think, heroin or morphine. He was an addict for sure.
So after Mexico, he later moved to North Africa. So it was a place, the Tangier International Zone. It was like a kind of autonomous zone that was, it was like a collaboration of the British, French, and Spaniards, like different kind of colonial powers. But it was like totally anarchic and totally like libertine.
Yep.
And that seems to be like where he got the inspiration for Naked Lunch from.
Yeah, and that's the book that everybody reads, right? I mean, if you're going to read Burroughs, they say, read Naked Lunch. And this is where, I don't know if he originated his method with it, but he really brought this cut-up technique is what it's called. And he apparently didn't create it, but he popularized it. And it actually looks like he was exposed to saying Brian Giesen's cut-up technique, which was from a painter. So he took this concept that he learned possibly in Paris, and he brought it to the novel, to the writing of prose. So he would sit on the floor and he'd write paragraphs and passages, and he would cut things and move things around to create this kind of schizoid or unusual and unexpected prose, which people still read, and that's a style that some writers will still dabble with, that kind of how to break things up so that the unexpected associations can emerge from randomness.
And he did have very a lot of kind of a conspiratorial thinker. The kind of paranoia, it is noticeable in Naked Lunch. He would perform like a kind of like an OCD like ritual to destroy like a person or establishment he had a problem with, and then the kind of theme of control, like the big lie or the big machine, and also his interest in dark magic.
Yeah, his family fortune came from this adding machine, this counting machine, and I think he felt a personal sense of irony at that, because he resented that world of the bean counting, everything has to be quantified. Of course, when you come from family money and you're rich, you can kind of have a certain disdain for it, right? But he was definitely bucking against that world of control and the kind of arch, call it what you want, a mercantile sensibility. Everything has to be counted. Everything has to be in order and logical. And we're trying to make sense of a universe that obviously he lived through a scenario where he encountered like a hellish kind of chaos, a hellish kind of darkness. And then to be homosexual and an American in the middle of the 20th century and all the rest, all the problems that.
But it does seem that both Wilde and Burroughs, what's interesting is they're both bi rather than just homosexual. It's hard to say, yeah, like if his wife was like a beard or if he was just flat out bi.
Yeah, right. It's difficult to say with both of them. You know, with Wilde, there's the quality of like he definitely loved his wife, and his wife supported him to the end. And with some obviously some major hiccups and problems. So what was that relationship? And with Burroughs, again, married, but then also had this kind of flirtation with almost, yeah, borderline pederasty. You know, that was sort of what he was up to in Tangiers, and or just like a real darkness and a kind of again, a life that now I just don't know how long this goes on now under the magnifying scrutiny of the Wokenista.
Was this kind of Burroughs lived in this kind of narrow window where it was after the era of like traditionalism and social conservatism, but it was before the era that we're in today, which is much more controlled. So there was like this narrow window, and especially like in the international zone, where of, yeah, like more freedom to be kind of anonymous, where you're free from traditional social bonds, but it was prior to the information age.
Right, and you have this quality with figures like Burroughs, people from this period. Even Anna Kavan is sort of a contemporary of his, also came from money, which this seems to be a trend. We're going to, as we go along, we're going to really try to explore different artists. We're starting kind of with a certain bent, but we're going to consciously make a choice to kind of veer away from maybe the more common names once we build an audience. And
but you said Stanley Kubrick will probably be next.
Yeah, that's for me. I'm excited to do that. Yeah, I think Kubrick's a fascinating figure, and I'm a big fan. You know, with Burroughs and Kavan, and I'm also thinking now about Hemingway, someone I know an awful lot about because I wrote a play about Hemingway and his final days, actually here in Minnesota. Many people don't know that Hemingway had two rounds of electroshock therapy at the end of his life at Mayo Clinic here in Minnesota. The final round was only a few days before he blew his brains out in Ketchum. But the point I'm making is that those kind of mid-century writers, in Kavan's case, kind of an internationalist Brit with money, in Burroughs and then in Hemingway's case, Americans, and Hemingway kind of maneuvered himself into money, but he had some, you know, in the beginning too. His father was a doctor. Burroughs came from some pretty serious family money. If you had serious American family money in the middle of the century, you could go literally almost anywhere in the world and just live with complete, you know, you were just completely at liberty. Impossible to overstate how far the dollar went. You read these stories about all these characters, and they're just constantly on the move. They're constantly traveling. They never seem to really have jobs. So, and then there's this unfortunate thing that happens where it's like, then those are the voices that you hear from. Then meanwhile, you got to go to work at wherever you got to go work. And then you can't figure out why you can't make art and all the rest of it.
I want to get back to like Burroughs and Naked Lunch, but
yeah,
I touched on this theme with the philosophy of Oscar Wilde, but what are your thoughts on like the economics of the arts and like the viability and the kind of economic mechanisms that influence like who gets discovered and who thrives?
Yeah, it's tricky. I certainly don't come from money, and yet I've managed to write plays and all the rest. I've had some help along the way. I was able to go to grad school on this fellowship at Texas, and I was able to spend 3 years more or less writing. Although it's kind of always clear, it's always clear when somebody has money. They just seem to, just things seem to go a little differently for them. Yeah, there is a real problem in the arts where it's adjacent to the problem of academia, in that the people who tend to be able to stick around and make the big careers in academia tend to not come from real working class or even increasingly lower middle class backgrounds. This is very well known, and the process by which things people are filtered out tend to be economic but also social and political. There are constant value tests. Are you one of us? Do you fit in? And all the rest. I think it's really, really hard to find authentic working and even increasingly middle class, lower middle class voices in the arts, because I think we're so hard pressed to find any time. And then beyond that too, people with families, if you start to have kids young, it's really, really tough to put together a lifestyle that's going to allow you to spend the time that it takes to go and pursue a PhD. There are people who do it. I admire people who accomplish it. But I personally have friends who I'm not going to name names, but I mean, one of the most brilliant people I know has made his way to Silicon Valley. He was in the process of getting a PhD in the history of science and had been doing some original contributions and winning fellowships and all the rest. But he had a number of kids, and at a certain point he just hit a wall and said, there's no future here. So you end up with this kind of ugly scenario where a vast category of people are excluded from the arts and from academia simply through economic pressure. And then you get what we have now, which is this resounding, overwhelming echo chamber where in the academy, at least publicly, everybody leans one direction, and if you don't, you're run out on a rail.
It doesn't seem like there's any viable economic or political solution. But there's been like the kind of the issues of like patronage, but throughout history, like going back to like the Renaissance, but it's always been like a struggle throughout history. There's no like one clear solution.
Yeah, I don't think there's an easy answer. Yeah, no, I but you know, there are promising things. I mean, we have what, these NFTs are very interesting. Can that get money into the hands of individual artists? The, you know, Substack, subscribers, Patreon, there are ways. And yeah, I'm kind of optimistic about the future of the arts. It's a very sticky subject. I'm sure we could go on and on and on about it, but yeah.
Yeah, with the Naked Lunch, it's obviously surreal, dreamlike, with a very disorienting plotline, but also kind of an obsessive writing style. Yeah, it's a bit kind of OCD, and then his own, like, personal obsessions, like his own, like, sexual fetishes are definitely referenced in Naked Lunch, and the fascination with the grotesque, the kind of influence, like the giant insects, like centipedes, the connection to being an exterminator, and a lot of his personal psychology, like you do feel like you're getting in his mind, like the paranoia, but also the obsession, and yeah, like his own kind of obsessions and fetishes are referenced, but then also like the theme of, yeah, mind control is a big theme too.
Yeah, and I think there's this idea that I encountered recently, and I can't recall the source, but it was something to the effect, well, it might have been something that I originated by reading something else. In any event, this idea of Americans being paranoid fascinates me, because from the last century, right? Because the Europeans, Europe and Britain went through it. They went through it on a scale that Americans simply didn't at home. The wars. And so, coming out of World War II, America developed this kind of arch paranoia.
And this was Naked Lunch. It was written in the 50s.
Yeah, right. And I think that it's probably an expression of that. And it's also a quintessential book in terms of fear of the suburbs and this sort of horror at what was going on in America at the time. Everybody's going to have a car. Mom and dad are going to be at home. You're going to have the 2.3 kids. we're going to have. You know, now that lifestyle seems like a fantasy for most.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
It's like, oh, gosh, take me back. But at the time...
So it was a theme of, like, of emptiness, but from prosperity, not missing out on not having, like, one's material needs denied. Yeah, it's also a theme, like, in a lot of film, like, suburban gothic, like, kind of like Lynch's Blue Velvet, as an example.
Yeah, David Lynch is all about this. Twin Peaks is all about this. Blue Velvet is all about this. There's this funny thing, though, that with that prosperity is that it always comes with strings attached. And these people who have the good fortune to be the Trustafarians, they have a lot of angst about it. And it isn't all gravy. Like, yes, you'd rather choose that, but it doesn't come from a void. And it comes with a lot of social expectations and a lot of obligations and a lot of weird guilt and all the rest. From what I can tell, I've known a few people. And I think Burroughs is a pretty good example of that. Man, oh man, I just want to be free. I don't want to be the adding machine heir. That doesn't define me. I have to do something else. I have to break up something. You know, I gotta do something with this. I think probably drove him.
I haven't seen Cronenberg's Naked Lunch yet. That'd be interesting to see. It's hard to kind of imagine. I think, like, Cronenberg obviously would have to tone down a lot of the material in that, but I haven't seen that yet, but I'm interested in checking that out. But I did recently watch Cronenberg's Nightcrawlers, and actually I had one of the actors in that on the show.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I don't think I've seen Nightcrawlers, and it's been a long time since I've seen the film version of Naked Lunch. But as I recall, I mean, it's a striking movie, probably worth screening. Throw it on and sort of see what it does to your brain. I really enjoyed the Blauergeist episode, by the way. I think
Blauer's
a great follow. Yeah, he's a great follow on Twitter. That dude is a lot of fun. Every time I take a nap, I think about him. I go, ah. You know.
We talked about cinema, different 80s films, including horror, and then we also, he posts like a lot of like aesthetic interior and architectural images.
Yeah, I really dig his stuff, and he has Dr. Jacoby from Twin Peaks as his avatar.
Oh yeah, it's kind of, it is, I mean, it is kind of like aestheticism, like presenting one's views, like instead of debating like political ideology, like the visual imagery stands on its own as like politics or philosophy.
Yeah, he seems to be making a point about aesthetics that is far-reaching, subtle, kind of like a collage. I mean, he's kind of a Twitter collage artist in a way, creating that account. I mean, I don't know what he thinks he's doing, but I really enjoy and appreciate it. I didn't realize he lives in Oregon.
But, oh yeah, I think he's from Portland. Yeah. So with Burroughs, there's also the obscenity trial. So Naked Lunch it was outright banned for a while in the United States. I think it may have been the last major book to be banned in the U.S. on obscenity grounds, and Norman Mailer, like, stood up for him in the trial. But I guess, William S. Burroughs, he was not overtly political, but he was kind of... he was kind of a libertarian, but like, as with, you described him as liberalism with a gun, so he was, had a kind of individualistic outlook. A lot of his writings was not woke by today's standards, but for his time, he did oppose, like, racism and homophobia. He was pro-gun, kind of a libertarian.
Yeah.
But then also he had a kind of aristocratic, radical strain, Oscar Wilde did.
Yes, yeah, there are some interesting parallels between the two. And, you know, he was I think they're saying Naked Lunch was the kind of the final book to be prosecuted as obscene in Massachusetts, and then other states followed course. But yeah, I think they beat that. So he was a really signature feature of the 60s counterculture. Yeah,
big time. He had also had a kind of view of... he references the Naked Lunch talks about like a matriarchy as oppression, but just in general, like, he is resentful of any kind of moral restrictions that society would impose upon the individual. So it is a radical individualistic and free from any kind of social controls kind of ideology.
Yeah, and of course, I'm sure for a figure like this, that's a matter of survival as much as anything else. This is a character who I just don't think could have made it, could have survived in a society in a sort of normal kind of a box.
I think he could have thrived like in a very narrow window, like what we said earlier, but I think he would have had it rough in like the 19th century, but also in like the very kind of controlled like cancel culture of today.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I'm reading here right now that he took one teaching position that Ginsberg got for him, but then he said, I'm never doing it again. They're quoting him here saying, you were giving out all this energy and nothing was coming back. Now, of course, that's amazing if you could afford to not have to do work like that, more power to you. Some people find it edifying and rewarding, but I think, again, for someone like this, this is a guy who was never house trained. You know, he was never gonna sit it on like like an advisory committee to see whether somebody gets tenure track or not. I don't think that he was. It's hard to imagine him doing that. And it has been a great disappointment of my life to see how academia, how kind of neutered and bureaucratic it's become.
With the history of academia, it was kind of originally academia was like a very small elite group, but there would be these like kind of eccentric geniuses who would be given, like, they would basically be supported, but then masses of people got in, and it's become very much, like, it's more about, like, it's more about the bureaucracy rather than the innovation and all these kind of strings attached. Like, you have this, yeah, I mean, you do have the kind of debate about education reform, but that seems to be the case.
Well, right, I mean, famously, the administration has bloated. And so you have more administrators, more office holders, more bureaucrats, more functionaries, and fewer professors in terms of a ratio. And then the professors have given away an awful lot of power at most of the universities, and the administrators now hold it. Polya has, to my mind, the most succinct and best take on it, which is the entire academic establishment is guilty of indenturing an entire generation of students into these horrible loans, and all these so-called leftist professors did nothing to stand up and prevent that or stop that. And it's devastated an entire generation of young people. It is a huge part of the ongoing kind of subterranean class war that's happening in America, and it's an absolute tragedy. You should listen to Polya on the subject. She would be an example of one of those eccentric professors. If you could take a class with her in Philadelphia, what an incredible thing. There are some other notable examples. But in a lot of cases, it's just, you know, degree farms, pump people through, try to get people through. And I went all the way through grad school. So there's a certain amount of hypocrisy here. But again, I was paid to take my MFA. I would never tell anyone, probably now increasingly, anyone with a trust fund to go to an MFA program where you pay $100,000, $150,000 to get some letters behind your name right now. Absolutely absurd. Go online, save the money, and if you're a good liberal, think about what you could do, you and your family could do with that money to materially support the people who actually need that money and not these administrators at these institutions which have completely become untethered from the reality of what it's like on the ground in America for most people. You want to have a fun day. Save the money for your applications and take a walk from the UCLA campus to, or is it the USC campus? Is it the USC campus or the UCLA campus?
I'm from LA. UCLA is on the west side and USC is downtown
right.
LA.
The USC campus. Take a walk from there and just walk right to Skid Row and have yourself a little nice little walk.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And yeah, brutal. And you've got literally the Brazilification of America and this apocalyptic landscape, and then you walk to the USC campus and it's Whole Foods and it's this completely cloistered, sheltered thing. I mean, no shade on anyone who goes to that school. More power to you. I hope it works out for you and your family. But let's not play this game and imagine that we're all quote unquote good liberals at these schools, because those institutions are anything but liberal in effect.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And with the debate about cancel culture, and I think it was, yeah, especially Burroughs is probably the most controversial, but, like, looking kind of at, because Burroughs was seemed to be well-respected back in the 80s and 90s when the culture was a more of a libertine culture, but it seems to be like we have this kind of, like, woke kind of neo-Puritanism today, and with cancel culture, like, these artists from the past are being analyzed, and I don't know if this has been an issue with kind of like Burroughs, but there's this kind of cliche about the cancel culture cliche versus the artist as a creator, like the redeeming qualities versus accusations of reprehensible behavior, and just kind of assessing these people because they're dead now, but assessing like their legacies and how that's being brought up in like the moral kind of moralism of cancel culture. So like, what are your I guess Burroughs could be one example, but it applies to a lot of public figures, both living and dead.
Yeah, we're applying a new standard, or maybe an old standard that's been updated to a different time, and there's a lot of nuance to be had here. Some of these artists get strange passes now too, because they're funneled through the trajectory of the 60s counterculture, and so they're still seen as necessary to the current generation of radicalism.
Yeah, because I think really, Burroughs, a lot of kind of liberal establishment types, I think because he's sort of a precursor to the 60s era, which has some kind of sacredness, that's excused, but there would be a double standard if you had someone who was younger, who was living today, and they were similar to Burroughs, but maybe outside of that woke framework, then they might have been denounced. So there's a kind of, it is like the framework, as you said, like where he fits in, because he was a precursor to that. That gives him respectability.
Yeah,
but there are a lot of cases where if someone is outside of the viewpoint of the establishment, then they would be completely like moralistically denounced. Like some woke types.
Yeah.
Remember, like some woke types, like, they wanted to like cancel the artist Gauguin because he was too
libertine.
Right.
Of course. Yeah. Right. Well, and Hemingway is another good example.
Oh yeah.
Hemingway now is considered completely passé, which is really unfortunate and frightening, because it's really difficult to overstate how important Hemingway's legacy is in terms of American letters, and just in terms of the work itself, and how people who, they don't really bother going beyond the surface, look at him and who he was. And of course, he was famously a man of the left.
Well, the example, like the Marquis de Sade, is respected in a lot of liberal circles because he was imprisoned for his writings, and then because he was kind of associated with the French Revolution, which was key to liberalism.
Right. Yeah, there's a lot of double standards happening. Ditto with Ginsberg, too. Ginsberg was associated with NAMBLA.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you have this kind of weird, okay, but, and yet everyone still has to read Howell and revere Howell. And it has to do with how pivotal and central those books are to the culture, and how they're still kind of considered to be right on, man. So it's tricky, but who knows how far it'll go and how deep it'll cut. We'll see. Are we reaching the end of this this witch hunt hysteria? Are we going to come out on the other end when the economic forces shift again and people kind of want to return to some sort of relaxation? Because it's a very tense way to live. And I don't think it can last forever. We'll see.
As things stand now, it's getting more, like, more oppressive cancel culture, like, to see, like, will there be a backlash and what happens? And it's hard, I mean, it is really hard to make these predictions. I do want to kind of mention, like, with the beatniks, like Burroughs and Ginsberg, contrasting them with the hippies, because the beatniks were a more kind of small elite group, while the hippies were basically, they were a mass movement, so it's much more kind of conventional. To make the kind of contrast, I think when you have a small elite group, it's going to be a lot more intellectually dynamic. I'm fascinated with the beatniks. The culture produced by the hippies is maybe like not as intellectually stimulating?
Yeah, I really don't know that I would think. I don't even associate the hippie movement with any sort of intellectualism.
Yeah, I don't think anything
intellectual.
Not at all.
Yeah, but definitely related. You are right, though. The Beatniks really did kind of what they kind of emerged out of the New York scene, New York, and then maybe San Francisco. I can't wait to do an episode on. Oh my God, why the Bukowski? I can't wait to do that.
Yeah,
episode.
Bukowski. What about Hunter? Yeah, and then Hunter S. Thompson too.
Oh yeah, yeah. We'll do the Hunter episode, and we're gonna play all the hits, but we're gonna try to mix it up with some names that maybe you haven't heard.
You should also do one on De Sade.
The Marquis de Sade.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Yeah, that'll be a fun one.
Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas is more. It's much less controversial, obviously, than Naked Lunch, but the writing style is a bit similar. And I think someone said, like, someone compared my writing style to both Burroughs and to, I think, Thompson to a degree.
Yeah, that's high praise. You know, one of my favorite factoids about Thompson is that he, when he was just a journeyman writer, he was trying to get his sea legs, he typed out the entirety of some of the great novels. So he picked up Faulkner, he picked up Hemingway, Fitzgerald.
He was sort of influenced by the Beats, but this was the 70s, so the era was a different era.
Yeah, he was a man on his own, for sure, but definitely influenced by the Beats and Hemingway. But he was great. Again, that's maybe a bit of a cliche guy to, you know, definitely part of the hits, but I went through my Thompson phase in the, when I was in university, and I think he's a good stopping point. Definitely kind of went off the rails as he got older, but he lived hard, and but he's worth reading. Fear and Loathing is still a good book to read. I actually prefer Hell's Angels. I think that's a great read. It's a really solid piece of journalism, trying to dig into this counterculture during a period where the Hell's Angels were the terror of the suburbs. Right, fascinating stuff. He got himself beat up for that book, doing the research on that one. So.
Yeah, he was. He was like a gonzo journalism is what he was known for. Besides being an author, Kevin, we're getting close to the end of the show. Do you want to plug your websites or any other upcoming projects?
Yeah, Robert, I really appreciate being had on the show here. This is a lot of fun. I like that you want to talk about philosophy and politics and really get into some of the. You know, the deeper end of the pool. I appreciate that. I'm at kevinkautzman.com. It's KAUTZMAN. If you're interested in the new play, it's moderationplay.com. And then the podcast is artofdarkpod.com. I'm pretty active on Twitter. I'm too active on Twitter. I'll spout off a lot there. And don't sleep on that play. I'm very excited about it. And that play really tackles...
And it will be available for the public to watch online.
Yeah, it will, right. So we're going to do it tomorrow evening. It's going to be released, and then I'm going to do a talk back, but that then will exist online. And, of course, my sincere hope is that after lockdown nonsense ends, the play will see productions in every major city across America, and so we can all go out and be in the theater again, and see our neighbors and see our friends and our family, and actually go and do something that's cultural, which maybe didn't come directly out of the funnel of what's approved and accepted by the quote unquote establishment, because it's a very difficult play that tackles the subject of social media and how it's slowly making us all crazy. Not brought to you by Facebook.
We'll check that out for sure. And Kevin Kautzman, great show, and thanks for being on.
Awesome. Thank you, Robert.